Chapter 34. Just as there is one man, more than any other, who emerges as the most likely suspect in the death of Marilyn Monroe, one man, still alive today, stands front and center as the prime suspect in the unwarranted, tragic death of Dorothy Kilgallen. Hairdresser Mark Sinclair believed that man, the mystery man whom Kilgallen met with during the early morning hours before she died, was Ron Paddicky, a Columbus, Ohio journalist and Kilgallen's last lover, though he denied the relationship was sexual. Several years of investigating Paddicky by this author, as first mentioned in The Reporter Who Knew Too Much, confirms him as the number one suspect, either by himself or, more likely, as will become apparent, an operative of those who had the strongest motive to eliminate the famous journalist. If so, Paddicky had a lasting effect on history, since if not for his actions, Kilgallen could have, it appears likely, published her book for Random House exposing those who had masterminded the JFK and Oswald assassinations and the cover-ups that followed. In a videotaped interview posted at thedorothykilgallenstory.org, Sinclair stated, "Dorothy and I talked for about an hour one day. Her life had been threatened. Finally, I said, 'The only new person in your life is Beau Paddicky. Why don't you ask him if all this information that is slipping out about you and your JFK investigation is coming from him?' Because she was concerned where people were getting the information from." He added, "Finally, after exhausting me over what was going on, I'm the one that suggested that she confront Beau Paddicky with it. I called him Beau because that's what she called him. And she was dead after that, 2 days later." During this author's continuing probe of Paddicky, there always remained a question as to how he may have put Kilgallen in danger through his actions during the days prior to her murder. But a true breakthrough exposed here for the first time makes it possible to better understand how evidence points to his complicity in her death. This evidence explains how those who feared Kilgallen's upcoming book learned what she intended to allege in it. The information adds the final piece of the puzzle regarding why Kilgallen's enemies came to the conclusion that she had to die so that her tell-all book could never be completed or published. In late 2019, a credible, confidential source, the Las Vegas Sands Hotel Casino pit boss during the 1960s, previously quoted, the one who experienced firsthand the workings of the underworld, the CIA, and the FBI during this period, told this author that Paddicky had landed in some kind of trouble prior to Kilgallen's death. The source, who knew Frank Sinatra on a personal as well as professional basis due to Sinatra's association with the Sands, confirmed through the source's Facebook page postings, had been sent by mafia associates in New York City to Vegas to check on a blackjack dealer who was supposedly cheating. Ultimately, he confirmed the dishonesty of the dealer while joking, "That dealer never cheated again," indicating mafia operatives killed him through a contract hit. The source then turned to his first-hand knowledge that Paddicky was saved from the trouble by what the source called rogue government agents. The source added that these rogue agents were apparently working for the CIA and/or FBI in tandem with underworld figures who were closely monitoring Kilgallen's JFK assassination investigation and her intention to publish the Random House book. According to the confidential source, a member of the New York Mafia at the time, who has no reason to lie, said that Paddicky, in exchange for being saved, agreed to become a mole he recruited and then managed to the extent that he would provide his handlers with the secret information Kilgallen had tripped on about the assassination, information that was lethal in nature. The source told this author that Kilgallen's fate was sealed, that she was dead, as he put it, when Paddicky betrayed her by squealing on her about the damaging evidence she possessed. The source's eerie account substantiates the belief that those who had been monitoring the dogged journalist's investigation of JFK's demise had decided to take action after these wrong people, likely including J. Edgar Hoover and Carlos Marcello, the latter of whom Kilgallen had connected to Lee Harvey Oswald and Jack Ruby, evaluated Paddocky's shocking disclosures. During this author's appearance on Gianni Russo's podcast Hollywood Godfather in March 2020, Russo was informed of what the source had suggested, and Russo intimated that the source's account made sense. He also confirmed the identity of the source, stating that he knew him when I started traveling to Vegas from New York City while working for Frank Costello. Others Russo mentioned that he knew included Mo Dalitz, Las Vegas businessman with ties to organized crime, Mickey Cohen, Milton Frank, who helped launch both the Golden Nugget and Mirage Hotels, and Jack Entratter, with management positions at the Copacabana nightclub in New York City and the iconic Sands Hotel in Las Vegas. I can go on, Russo told this author. These are some of the people I delivered messages to from Frank Costello. If the source's account is truthful, and his credentials are rock solid, permitting him to be in a position to know what happened to Kilgallen, the danger she was facing had reached the boiling point, and her death was a certainty in one of those not-if-but-when moments. One little-known confirmation of Kilgallen becoming a certain target originated from a statement made by undercover CIA operative Frank Sturgis, one of the Watergate burglars, in 1977 to Marita Lorenz. She was a German-born American woman who had an affair with Fidel Castro in 1959, and a year later was involved in an assassination attempt on Castro by the CIA. Recalling time spent with Sturgis, Lorenz stated, "We were walking down York Avenue in NYC, and Sturgis was bragging about all of his exploits, and he said, 'We can kill anybody we want. Just blame it on national security.' He said columnist Dorothy Kilgallen got whacked because of her intention to publish a book which included information from her exclusive interview with Jack Ruby." Ron Paddocky was 22 years younger than Kilgallen, who was 51, when he met her in June 1964, 3 months after the Jack Ruby trial ended. She had been quite the busy columnist prior to this time, with one exclusive column entitled "Hope Makes a Bid to Beatles." The opening line, "Bob Hope is offering the Beatles a fabulous fee to appear in one of his next flickers." Other celebrities mentioned in the column included Joan Crawford, Audrey Hepburn, and Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh. In addition, she had penned a column entitled, "Shirley MacLaine Has Eye on Funny Girl," referring to the actress's interest in starring with Frank Sinatra in the film version of the successful play. The consensus appears to be that Kilgallen and Paddocky, who had earned a degree in journalism from Ohio State University in 1959, before becoming the film and drama critic for the Columbus Citizen Journal in 1961, met during a 20th Century Fox European press junket for three upcoming films. They were The Sound of Music, The Agony and the Ecstasy, and Those Magnificent Men in Their Flying Machines. Kilgallen attracted as much attention as did the movie stars during the junket. They included Charlton Heston and Julie Andrews. Her Journal American colleague, Louis Sobel, said Kilgallen called Heston Chuckles. He called her Dottie. A Canadian Broadcasting Network crew from the program This Hour Has 7 Days joined the junket, and 7 months later, on January 10, 1965, it aired a segment including interviews with several of the three film's stars, including Andrews, Heston, Rex Harrison, and Sarah Miles. Kilgallen is on camera several times and also interviewed regarding time spent with Heston. Lurking in the background is Ron Paddocky as he takes photos of Julie Andrews. Video is available at thedorothykilgallenstory.org. Paddocky's sturdy build and good looks had already captured the hearts of celebrity women, including Frank Sinatra's future wife Mia Farrow and Italian operatic singer and sultry actress Anna Maria Alberghetti. Each had been younger than he was, but neither approached the 20-plus age difference between him and Kilgallen. According to Camille Renoir, Paddicky, whom she knew through her mother, a Hollywood public relations executive in the 1990s who represented big-name celebrities, had a thing for women who could improve his social status. She told this author, "Ron was quite charming, really, good-looking, but starstruck with women, wanted to be around celebrities. He had some good pickup lines, reminded me of Robert Wagner when he was young, the kind of guy who liked the glamour of Hollywood, wanted to be part of the beautiful people, but never made it." Asked whether Paddicky was a womanizer, Renoir stated, "Not exactly, but I could see it. He was like somebody who had a plan and then carries it out, like a schemer. Saw women as an opportunity, used people, used my mom to get to her famous friends. Not genuine, didn't respect women. One who could turn on the charm when he wanted something. I felt like Ron would have liked to have found a rich wife and just made the rounds of the parties." During the mid-2000s, a magazine researcher of note told this author he asked Paddicky during an audio-recorded interview why he was attracted to Kilgallen, a woman much older. He replied, "For all of her brashness in print, she was very poetic. Dorothy was a dyed-in-the-wool romantic, to be sure, a very soft person. I never saw her angry. I don't think, other than strictly business, something like discussing the Jack Ruby thing, Dorothy and I ever had a serious conversation. She was a sweet lady, my best friend in the whole world." Filling in the blanks about Paddicky's romantic relationship with Kilgallen, one, it appears, may have been just another example of his using a woman to further his own goals to reach the big time. Kilgallen backed Paddicky in an ill-advised venture into the music business, and his ideal position to snitch on her may best begin with notes sent to Paddicky by Kilgallen. In one note, she calls him Sweetie and talks of his coming to New York City in the fall of 1965, strongly indicating the intimate relationship she had with him. Up to and including 2020, Paddicky's statements to this author conflict with each other and the physical evidence connected to Kilgallen's death. These statements include whether the relationship was romantic, how he learned of her death, whether she shared her JFK assassination investigation with him, whether he stayed at the Regency Hotel with her in a room she arranged, and, most importantly, whether he was in New York on the 7th and 8th of November 1965. In each instance, Paddicky tells a different story, provides confusing answers or downright lies. Paddicky's cousin John Downing told his friend Ken Edwards, confirmed by cousin Joyce Darling, that Paddicky's relationship with Dorothy was definitely sexual, that Dorothy had given Paddicky an apartment house and a Thunderbird automobile, and that Paddicky said he was the last person to see Dorothy alive. Darling called Paddicky a boy toy and a gigolo, and stated that Kilgallen had given him the car. The existence of the Thunderbird was confirmed by Brenda Desjardins during her interview with this author. To be certain, Paddicky had a history of violence, first with Alberghetti and also with former NFL football player Jim Otis. 7 months before Kilgallen began an affair with the journalist, a headline in his local newspaper read, "Paddicky arrested, slugged, he says. Party with actress Anna Maria Alberghetti at friend's home ends roughly." She was best known for films such as Cinderfella, The Last Command, and Duel at Apache Wells. As first exposed in The Reporter Who Knew Too Much, Paddicky, apparently inebriated, picked up a glass coffee table and threw it across a room. The police were called by the actress, who refused to provide her name but was pegged as an Italian beauty, stating, "Something in Ron's brain clicked when he drank and he went bananas." She added that Paddicky admitted previous instances, including his having rammed his car into five others. Alberghetti called Paddicky violent and nutsy. Another example of Paddicky's alarming behavior came from former NFL player Jim Otis. He told this author he contacted Columbus police after Paddicky threatened him with a blackjack and fired four shots at him with a .38 caliber pistol as he left the house. Paddocky denied being in New York City at the time of Kilgallen's death, but his account does not hold up. He claimed, among other assertions, that a fashion editor named Jane Horrocks read him the sad news of Kilgallen's death from the newswire at his newspaper office in Columbus, Ohio. But Horrocks denied this account during an interview with this author's researcher, stating, "At the time of Kilgallen's death, I was covering fashion showings in California." In fact, Paddocky swore he was not in New York City until 2 or 3 weeks after she died. But the facts show that 4 days after failing to attend Kilgallen's funeral on the 11th of November 1965, Paddocky actually partied in the city. When confronted with his apparent lie, and without yet having been accused of wrongdoing, he exclaimed, "What did I do? Hire my own jet, fly to New York, kill her, and then fly back in a hurry?" Evidence incriminating Paddocky in Kilgallen's death includes multiple inconsistent accounts by him and outright lies concerning his relationship with Kilgallen during the last months of her life. The former journalist's actions through the years reveal him to be a psychopath with pathological tendencies toward violence. Such behavior appears to have been common throughout Paddocky's life. In another instance, this one in 1968, Paddocky wrote a column entitled "Jimi Hendrix, The Final Experience." Here he boasts, "I met the young singer once, quite by accident. It was a curious scene." He then told how the rock star and two companions discussed LSD and cocaine as easily and comfortably as I might discuss a bottle of Michelob. In the final paragraph of the column, he summarized his feelings about Hendrix, writing, "My intention today is not to sermonize. I think the drug-saturated corpse of a 24-year-old is sermon enough." Primary sources Wayne and Hazel Shepherd, a husband and wife team of rock musicians who spent a great deal of time with Hendrix during the only appearance he ever had in Columbus, discount Paddocky's account. They believe Paddocky was making up the story to play the big shot, which was another common trait of his. Paddocky certainly showed his stripes as a person who lacked truthfulness when discussing whether Kilgallen shared her JFK assassination research with him. Recall that when describing his relationship with her, he said they had never had a serious conversation other than strictly business, except something like discussing the Jack Ruby thing. A sure contradiction, since talking about the Jack Ruby thing, if it happened, meant she had shared inside information about the man she believed to be the real key to solving the JFK assassination. Further confirmation of Paddocky lying about his interaction with Kilgallen regarding her investigation stems from an October 22, 2014 interview with this author. Asked if Kilgallen had confided in him, Paddocky first denied it before admitting he met Melvin Belly with Kilgallen a couple of times in New York City after the Ruby trial. He then acknowledged that she did confide in him, stating, "Sure, we worked on it, the manuscript. I think she was probably 50% researched on that. She was getting close, I can tell you. If you have 50% of your project finished, it's all downhill from there. The other 50% is filling in the blanks, you know." During a subsequent interview, when asked about his not attending Kilgallen's funeral, Paddocky said, "I could not have gone, no, I couldn't have gone. The most important thing in my life had been removed." He added, "Keep in mind, we spoke nearly every day, and at length. I helped her with many projects, and she helped me. She'd call and say, 'Let me read something to you.' One was the lead to the Jack Ruby story, and she said, 'I don't like the lead very well. What do you think?' And I said, 'Well, it's a little dry. Why don't you try to make it a little mysterious? Like two unidentified men sat in a nightclub talking in hushed tones.' She had told me this is what happened, part of the Jack Ruby story. One was Jack Ruby talking in a nightclub, but she didn't make it sinister enough given the nature of the story. I just rattled that off, and she said, 'Let me get that down.'" Paddocky's admissions regarding his knowledge of Kilgallen's JFK assassination evidence she intended for her tell-all book, certainly poison to anyone who had anything to do with the assassination, made him as vulnerable as Kilgallen to her enemies, who were determined not to let her write the book for Random House. In effect, Pataki had become the perfect pigeon to be plucked by those who could compromise him and turn him into a snitch, since he had the same lack of ethics and morals exhibited by the Kennedys. Smoking guns regarding Pataki's complicity in Kilgallen's death are in the form of two very incriminating poems obtained by this author that he admits writing. The first, titled "Never Trust a Stiff at a Typewriter," includes the stanza, "There's a way to quench a gossip's stench that never fails. One cannot write if zippered tight. Somebody who's dead could tell no tales." The second poem, written below a bartender mixing drinks, was titled "Vodka Roulette Seen as Relief Possibility." Author's note, these poems were viewed on Pataki's website on February 16, 2016. He subsequently removed them shortly thereafter. Regarding the first poem, Pataki's first cousin Belva Elliott, John Downing's sister, said, "There is no reason to dig up the past. Don't want to hurt Ronnie, but he admitted poems he wrote about the poisoning, about the zippered tight, were about Dorothy." Elliot added, "Ron told me Kilgallen was poisoned because she was too close to the truth about the JFK assassination. Ron wouldn't say by whom, and yes, Kilgallen bought an apartment for Ron and a Thunderbird, and Ron said he talked to Dorothy just before she died." Elliot claimed Kilgallen told Ron her life was in danger before stating that the family was known as the Drunken Downings of Vermilion County. Ron drank with John Downing, and when people drink, they tell the truth. While the first poem about being zippered tight fits perfectly with silencing Kilgallen, the second poem is most incriminating since it contains a plausible set of facts as to how Kilgallen, as will be shown, was murdered that only the killer could know, since these facts had never been released to the public. When this author confronted Pataki with the substance of the two poems, he said, "They are humorous and have nothing to do with Dorothy." He did admit connections to mobster Sam Giancana, Carlos Marcello's close friend, through his friendship with singer Phyllis McGuire, one of the three famous McGuire sisters. At one point, Pataki boasted of knowing Giancana, while also boasting he hit on McGuire and that she was willing to be involved with him. Neither boast turned out to be true, but nevertheless they circulated in the underworld to knowing mobsters, including Sam Giancana. Asked to be more specific, Pataki said, "I knew Sam Giancana through Phyllis McGuire. Drunk one night, I tried to put the make on her. That didn't work." This encounter apparently happened when Phyllis appeared at the Kenley Players Summer Theater in Columbus, Ohio, in the musical comedy Little Me. Interest by this author in the former member of the McGuire sisters, popular singers with such hits as Sincerely, Sugar Time, also the title of an HBO film about Phyllis and Giancana she attempted to block from being released, and All I Have to Do Is Dream, stems from the Vanity Fair article previously mentioned, written by Dominic Dunn. According to a CIA file entitled CIA Inspector General's Report on Plots to Assassinate Fidel Castro, Kilgallen was friendly with Phyllis McGuire. The account read, "Johnny Roselli, mafia associate of Sam Giancana, found himself facing a table at ringside at which Phyllis McGuire was sitting with Dorothy Kilgallen and Liberace for the opening night of singer Rosemary Clooney." McGuire certainly had a love affair with Giancana, as proven by multiple accounts through the years. In an attempt to contact McGuire, this author sent letters and a copy of The Reporter Who Knew Too Much to her at her home in Las Vegas. Why? Because she was quoted in the Vanity Fair article as stating she considered Kilgallen's death to be suspicious and that she knew something about it, but she declined to be interviewed. This was surprising, since, according to McGuire's account, in a San Diego Union-Tribune article published on November 19, 1995, She leaned on Kilgallen for advice during the time when she was romantically involved with Giancana. After stating that she had just happened to fall in love with Sam the man, not the crime figure, she said she recalled a visit from gossip queen Dorothy Kilgallen just before the affair became an international scandal, with the columnist telling her, "Phyllis, get out of this. This is very bad for you. I'm telling you this as a good friend." Despite the warning, McGuire wrote that, "I looked up at Kilgallen with tears in my eyes and said, 'Dorothy, it is too late.'" Regarding Johnny Roselli, he was known as a mob fixer in Las Vegas, involved in the plot to assassinate Castro. On August 9, 1976, Roselli's decomposed body was found by a fisherman in a 55-gallon steel fuel drum floating in Dumfoundling Bay near Miami, Florida. The connection of Kilgallen to McGuire to Giancana may have permitted Carlos Marcello to keep tabs, through Ron Pataki, on Kilgallen's continuing JFK assassination investigation and the book she was writing. Certainly, these mobsters fit the "wrong people" description the Las Vegas source provided. Putting the squeeze on Pataki to snitch on Kilgallen and thus recruit him to keep them apprised of her JFK assassination investigation turned out to be the perfect fit, since she shared that information with Pataki based on his admissions as November 1965 neared. Of interest is the credibility of the Las Vegas casino boss source. During this author's interview with him, focused mainly on his friendship with Frank Sinatra, it was only in the final moments of the interview, practically as an afterthought, that I asked, "Have you ever heard the name Ron Pataki?" Without hesitation, the source said yes, and then spilled the incriminating evidence against him without any prodding. Based on that account, one must wonder whether Pataki knew that the wrong people intended to silence Kilgallen. Perhaps at first he believed they were simply going to scare her into stopping her investigation and the writing of her book. But if he did, he figured wrong, since, as the source said, the moment these wrong people learned of her intentions, she was dead. Could Pataki have killed Kilgallen either by himself or with the help of the wrong people? Camille Renoir, mentioned before, told this author, "Not actually kill someone unless, that is, his life was in danger. He'd be afraid to kill, but if pressured, perhaps by mafia guys, I can see him doing it." Continuing, Renoir said, "I could see Ron delivering Dorothy to the townhouse where professionals, those who wouldn't blink an eye to kill, were waiting, money and pressure applied to get him to do it." Regarding the poems Pataki wrote, Renoir told this author, "They could be construed toward guilt, of his pulling troubling events out of his subconscious, of having a hand in Dorothy's death." Curious as to a mental health professional's opinion about Pataki's mental makeup based on the incidents of bizarre behavior before, during, and after Kilgallen's murder, this author, after being contacted by New Jersey clinical psychologist Jeffrey C. Danko, asked him his opinion about Pataki and our communications through the years. Danko's experience in this type of analysis includes a professional relationship with convicted New York City serial murderer David Berkowitz. Danko did make it clear that he did not interview Pataki, but his analysis is nevertheless quite revealing. 1. The poems. It's not simply that Pataki wrote them that's so incriminating, it's that he published them. Why would he take such a risk of exposing himself if not for the presence of unresolved guilt that simply overwhelms his better judgment to lay low and keep quiet? One of the classic treatments of guilt in literature is Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. There you see the protagonist inexorably moving toward his fate for having killed a pawnbroker. He simply can't live with himself, and his anxiety over being exposed and brought to justice is commingled with his inner sense of deserving such condemnation. Woody Allen picked up on the exact same theme in his great movie Crimes and Misdemeanors. In fact, given the credible allegations of Allen's sex abuse, one wonders if he was trying to expiate his own guilt in making the movie. 2. Paddocky's study to become a Christian counselor. He attended an online seminary. Paddocky was a theater critic and journalist. While such employment does not preclude his interest in the Bible or church-related activities, when you couple it with his chronic abuse of alcohol, there's something that just doesn't fit there. Trinity, which Paddocky attended, is a very conservative institution, well known for its commitment to biblical orthodoxy, like my school, the Rosemead School of Psychology. It would seem to me that Paddocky would be out of place there, unless his purpose for taking classes had little to do with wanting to be a people helper. Instead, he's a man convincingly portrayed as a wannabe, a would-be star, who could not be interested in the very private and confidential exchanges that take place with clients in psychotherapy. So my assumption is that Paddocky just wanted to assume the role of a pious, religiously oriented facilitator of human flourishing, canceling out his background as a womanizer and sometimes violent drunk, or a murderer. 3. Finally, to me, perhaps the most compelling evidence for his guilt expiation is the plain fact that he submitted to so much investigation and scrutiny by you, Mark, the author. You approached him not as an officer of the court, but as a writer. He had no obligation to talk to you at all. I think that he cooperated so long to try to assuage his conscience, to show that he had nothing to hide. He shows passive-aggressive behavior throughout the transcripts you provide, so his defenses were obviously brittle. He never would have confessed his role in her death to you, but I think he was trying to say without saying, "You may be on to something, Shaw. You'll never know the truth, because I couldn't live with the consequences. But I can't easily live with my conscience, either. So I invite you into my world of inner tension and fear, and then I don't feel so alone." Doesn't that sound plausible? A final unrelated thought. Paddocky had to be jealous of Dorothy, as she was everything he wasn't. Great notoriety through her syndicated column and What's My Line gig, living in luxury, friend to the stars, and better able to handle alcohol than he did. How ironic, then, that it was a drug cocktail that killed her. Danko's analysis speaks for itself regarding the mindset of Paddocky regarding all aspects of his involvement in Kilgallen's life and her death. So as to be fair and provide him an opportunity to respond, a copy of Danko's report was emailed to Paddocky on June 22, 2020. No reply was received. Labeling Paddocky, as noted, as a pathological liar with psychopathic tendencies is no stretch of the imagination. These are the typical symptoms, according to multiple medical journals. Poor control over behavior. Using others, a parasitic lifestyle. Superficial charm and glibness. Inflated sense of self-worth. Constant need for stimulation. Lying pathologically. Conning others, being manipulative. Sincere lack of remorse or guilt. Callousness, lack of empathy. Paddocky's behavior, especially before and after Kilgallen's death, fits the definitions of a psychopath like the proverbial glove. Any psychiatrist would welcome the chance to interview the troubled man, the man the New York D.A. Cyrus Vance Jr. and NYPD Commissioner Dermot Shea has thus far let go free, to probe deeply into his psyche, to learn the real truth about the man who Kilgallen loved and trusted, and who, in the end, betrayed her. Two examples make the point. First, Paddocky stated in September 2014 that New York City police interviewed him after Kilgallen's death. Asked how the authorities would have known about him, Paddocky said they discovered a note with his name on it on the nightstand in the bedroom where the authorities found Kilgallen's body. This story appears to be completely untrue, since no mention of any note or the police contacting Paddocky appeared in any report. Paddocky also never mentioned either the note or the police contacting him in any of the many interviews he has given before. Even more revealing, Paddocky disclosed, "Dorothy lived in a lavish townhouse, but I never set foot in it. Paddocky later admitted. I saw her take pills many times. I saw them in her medicine cabinet, which means he had in fact been inside the townhouse to the extent of having visited the third-floor bathroom she used, the one next to the bedroom where her dead body was discovered. Author's note, more evidence regarding Paddocky's complicity in Kilgallen's death may be learned in The Reporter Who Knew Too Much and Denial of Justice. Like other powerful women Paddocky had preyed upon, Kilgallen fell prey to a womanizer with loose morals and few ethics who used her to gain stature, hoping he could escape from a small-town Columbus dead-end job into the big-time world of New York City, where he could be a somebody instead of a nobody, as described by a close friend. Today, in his mid-80s, Paddocky still lives in Columbus, surely a haunted man who has thus far survived prosecution despite this author's continuing attempts to bring him to justice.